Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the massacre of schoolchildren by the Pakistan Taliban and speak with Shuja Nawaz, who is a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He is the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States and is the author of Crossed Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. And we will discuss the apparent retaliation by the Pakistan Taliban against the government of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif that has recently dramatically increased its targeting of the Pakistan Taliban in the tribal regions, including North Waziristan, where the previously untouchable Haqqani network has been under attack from government airstrikes. Then, with President Obama about to sign a bill increasing sanctions on Russia, we will look into the free fall of the Russian ruble and desperate intervention by the Russian central bank, which raised interest rates from 10.5% to 17%, while the ruble, having lost half of its value against the dollar this year, fell as low as 79 rubles to the dollar. Barry Eichengreen, a professor of economics and political science at the University of California, Berkeley, who served as a senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund, joins us to discuss the economic crisis Putin is facing from increased sanctions and falling oil prices, none of which is being reported by the Russian media. Then finally, Middle East expert Juan Cole joins us in the studio to discuss the latest so-called act of Islamic terrorism in Sydney, Australia, that made international news because a demented self-proclaimed imam decided to align himself with the so-called Islamic State by taking hostages, two of whom were killed along with him. We will discuss the continuing hype associated with the Islamic State that most Arabs derisively refer to as Daesh, since these thugs, rapists, and murderers have nothing to do with Islam. But nevertheless, any deranged individual can act in the name of the Islamic State and be guaranteed global headlines. And joining us now is Shuja Nawaz, who is a native of Pakistan, who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst. He's worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and is currently the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. He's the author of Crossed Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you very much, Ian. My pleasure being on the air with you again.
And it's good to talk to you again, Shuja, and I wish it were under better circumstances. But there does seem to be a sort of subtext to this atrocity where 132 schoolchildren and nine members of the staff were killed by the Pakistan Taliban. It does seem that there's much greater cooperation now between Pakistan's government and military and the new government in Afghanistan, and I believe that Hamid Karzai was holding some members of the Pakistan Taliban in retaliation for Pakistan harboring Afghan Taliban. But the new leader seems to have changed that, and a number of high-level Pakistan Taliban people have been turned over, and I believe that the Pakistan military has been striking not just in South Waziristan, but also in North Waziristan.
Yes, indeed. And you're quite right. The relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan appears to be on the mend, largely, I think, because of the initiative of President Ashraf Ghani, who chose to go to Pakistan and, among others, met the army chief and the prime minister. And then he went to China. And I think China is going to be a critical catalyst in this regional effort to control militancy. It has a very powerful relationship with Pakistan, and that will have an effect on how Pakistan approaches militancy of all colors and shapes.
So is that to say that the U.S. is pulling out, or its influence in Pakistan is either receding because of U.S. actions or because of Pakistan's, the ongoing hostility? And would this be replaced by China? Do you think the U.S. in any way is giving up on Pakistan?
I don't think the U.S. is giving up on Pakistan, but there is obviously an Afghanistan fatigue. And as the U.S. Starts winding down its involvement with active operations in Afghanistan, the desire of the Congress particularly will be to reduce the U.S.'s financial assistance to the region. But as today's events indicate, the fighting, the insurgencies, the militancy are not going to subside simply because the coalition has stopped active operations in Afghanistan. They're going to continue, and the U.S. will have to consider whether it remains its strategic interest to stabilize Afghanistan and to ensure that Pakistan doesn't suffer any contagious effects of the activities that have emerged in Afghanistan through the Afghan Taliban and also through the Pakistani Taliban.
Well, isn't that something that's perhaps gotten the government of Pakistan's and the armies and the ISI's attention, that they could be faced with what's called reverse sanctuary, where Pakistan, if the Afghan Taliban take over Afghanistan and it becomes a Taliban state, then the Pakistan Taliban could seek refuge in Afghanistan and launch attacks back into Pakistan?
Absolutely, and I think this is something that has concentrated their minds. They are, in fact, using this as an opportunity to rebuild the relationship first with the United States. And the United States has repaid them by using its drones inside Afghanistan on some targets that are identified as the Pakistani Taliban, who were seeking sanctuary on the Afghan side of the border. So there is now a slight improvement in the military-to-military relationship of the United States and Pakistan, and there appear to be signs that there is greater intelligence collaboration too.
Again, I'm speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who is a native of Pakistan. He's worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst, has also worked for the World Health Organization and was director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and is currently the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. He's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. It does seem, though, that, you know, if popular culture is to be considered a yardstick for geopolitical relations, there is a popular television series on Showtime called Homeland, the plot of which is now set in Islamabad in Pakistan and the American embassy. And the show is incredibly hostile towards Pakistan's government and the ISI and the military in terms of duplicity, you get the impression that, you know, perhaps I don't know who's the script advisor on it, but it's pretty blatantly anti-Pakistan in its content, and I find that surprising. Have you seen it at all, Shuja?
I had actually heard of the show. I'd never seen the earlier seasons. I was approached by people on the show to talk with them, but I think it was late in the game. I'm actually finding that it is much more ambiguous about some of the relationships, and it does actually show also that members of the inter-services intelligence are collaborating with their U.S. counterparts in some instances. So in some ways, it is showing the ambiguity that surrounds the intelligence relationships. Ian, if I might also make a small correction in your introduction, and I don't blame you for continuing to introduce me as the director of the South Asia Center. I've only recently stepped aside from that, and I'm now a distinguished fellow at the center.
Okay.
So I just wanted to make sure your audience understands that I have a different relationship with the Atlantic Council now. I'm no longer active.
Well, just to follow on from Homeland, is that to say that there is a more honest relationship, you know, between Pakistan and the United States at the moment, where, you know, the gloves are off and people are not pretending anymore, or as we discussed earlier, there are indications that there are actually some real improvements in the relationship.
I think there is some improvement. I don't know if one can use the word honesty when it comes to relationships between intelligence agencies. There is an element of honesty and sharing, but, you know, it's enlightened self-interest that guides these relationships. And I think the Pakistanis and their American counterparts now realize the importance of leveling with each other. But it's still early days. I think it will be very critical to see if the public message that is coming from the Pakistan military leadership about not differentiating between different militant groups, including the Haqqanis and the Pakistani Taliban, is followed up with evidence of actions or killed or captured leadership of these different groups. So that is really an element where Congress particularly will be keeping a sharp eye as it decides on how much money to continue giving Pakistan for its operations in that border region between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, the Pakistan military have killed a high-level leader of al-Qaeda, who's a naturalized American citizen. He was killed in South Waziristan on December the 6th, and the U.S. had been holding one of the Pakistan Taliban's leader, Latif Masood. They've been holding him for, I think, since October of 2013 in Afghanistan, and they've turned him over to Pakistan. So it actually handed over three senior Pakistan Taliban leaders to Pakistan's authorities. So something's happening there, and I'm surprised, actually, that the U.S. had held these people as long as they had.
Well, I think these are all good signs, but as I said, this is not yet an established trend, and we hope it will be one. But more important, I think, is the trend between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where it's not just at the upper levels of government that they are talking to each other, but at the operational level in the border region, they're talking to each other, so that the decades-old mistrust between them is removed. Pakistan will need that for its own benefit, because once the coalition departs from Afghanistan, Pakistan needs to ensure that there's a stable Afghanistan, because if there is civil war in Afghanistan, if there's unrest and instability in Afghanistan, it will have a contagion effect on Pakistan. It will also lead to the reverse sanctuary that you were talking about for Pakistani militants.
So Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has pledged to avenge the killing of these school children at the Army Public School, along with their teachers. And he has described it as a national tragedy unleashed by savages. And quoting the Prime Minister, "We will take revenge for each and every drop of our children's blood that was spilt today." He's always had pretty prickly relationships with the Army, and there have been reports in Pakistan that the famous cricket player turned politician has been a kind of stalking horse for either the Army or elements in the Army. So where does Sharif's political authority stand now?
Well, he still commands a pretty solid majority in Parliament, but he has been on the back foot ever since Imran Khan, the opposition politician whose party is heading the coalition in the border Khyber Pakhtunkhwa region, launched his public demonstrations alleging that the elections had been rigged. Those demonstrations continue, and so Prime Minister Sharif appears to have lost some of his political strength over the last year and a half. I think this tragedy offers him the opportunity to assert his position as a national leader, to bring the army on board, and to, in tomorrow morning's meeting with the other political parties, forge a real consensus against militancy of all shapes and sizes within the country, without any discrimination. they will then have to work with the military in ensuring that this rhetoric is matched by their actions. He has a great opportunity also in an institution that he's finally created, which successive governments have been delaying, which is the National Counterterrorism Authority. But he needs to give it strength and give it teeth and bring the military into it so that it becomes a joint effort. And then this can take over from the military once they clear an area and can also launch preemptive operations to identify potential attacks. There's a lot that needs to be done, and I think he has an opportunity to show that he is doing it rather than simply relying on populist rhetoric.
Well, it would seem, though, that this hideous incident in Peshawar, I think, wouldn't that undercut Imran Khan's popularity and credibility? Because to some extent, he's sort of been turning a blind eye to this kind of terrorism. He's attacking the Sharif, but at the same time, you know, there have been these hideous attacks. There were 80 people killed at a church in Peshawar in September of last year. They bombed the Hazara Shia minority in the city of Quetta, and I know that people were furious with Imran Khan for not taking a sufficiently strong stand in condemning that. There were, of course, 80 more were killed of the minority Ahmadi sect in Lahore as well. So is that fair to suggest that Imran Khan has not been particularly forthright in his condemnation of the Pakistan Taliban and their actions?
Well, I think he still has some confusion in his mind about how to deal with the Taliban. He believed at one time very strongly that the only way of dealing with them was by talking to them, and that they really were good at heart. But as you say, this litany of their sins has been mounting, and people are noticing that he has been less than forthright in his condemnation. I understand, and I haven't seen all the reports of his comments on this attack, that he has refused to blame the Taliban directly for this particular attack, even though they've taken the responsibility. If that is so, this will give strength to his opponents, who often refer to him as Taliban Khan instead of Imran Khan. And that may be unfair, but he needs to have a much stronger public position that he is willing to support. Now, in fairness to him, he has called off his nationwide strike and agitation that was supposed to be launched on December 18th. And is participating in the national days of mourning for the tragedy in Peshawar. But we have to wait to see what actions, if any, the provincial government takes against the Taliban militants within their own territory, particularly with the attack occurring in provincial capital, Peshawar.
Well, indeed, even the Afghan Taliban has come out and condemned this attack. I thank you for joining us, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you very much, Ian. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. Again, I've been speaking with Shuja Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst, has also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and is now a distinguished fellow at the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the free fall of the Russian ruble and the economic crisis Putin is facing from increased sanctions and falling oil prices. This is Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Barry Eichengreen, who's a professor of economics and political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He is a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, a research fellow of the Center for Economic Policy Research, and previously served as senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund. His books include Emerging Giants, China and India in the World Economy, What G20 Leaders Must Do to Stabilize Our Economy and Fix the Financial System, and China, Asia, and the New World Economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barry Eichengreen.
Thank you.
And the Russian ruble is in freefall despite the central bank's dramatic rise in interest rates from 10.5% to 17%. And what's extraordinary about this run on the ruble is that the Russian people have no idea it's happening.
Yeah, I think the Russian people are going to find out soon enough. The measures that the central bank took on Monday are not working. There's going to have to be more radical action now that will prevent money from fleeing the country and make it harder for food and other merchandise to come in. And when that happens, the Russian people will notice.
Well, the ruble's been fluctuating. The intervention sort of has kept it around 58 to the dollar, but it's gone as low as 79 rubles to the dollar. What's your sense of whether this will get worse? In fact, whether there'll be a run?
Well, I do think it'll get worse before it gets better. That what the central bank has done is to give a small financial incentive for people to keep their money in the country. For people to keep their money on deposit in the banks. And against that, they have to weigh the fact that central bank action to raise interest rates does nothing to address the problems created by weak oil prices. It does nothing to address the problems for Russia created by Western sanctions. And it does nothing to address the corruption problem. So when the currency moves this dramatically, people wake up and take notice of those facts. And that's why I think the central bank's measure, which worked for a few hours as a holding action, will not be enough.
And of course, high interest rates slow economic growth, and Russia is heading into recession. So again, the news is not good.
That's right. High interest rates will help more than they hurt if they're temporary. But while they're temporarily in place, it's important to do things about those other problems. And Mr. Putin is not in a position to do anything about oil prices, which are determined by OPEC and globally, about Western sanctions, which he, given that he's in no position to back down vis-a-vis the West, and about corruption. So I think it's clear that the high interest rates, by making the slowdown in Russia even worse, are going to compound their problems and are going to have to be abandoned in favor of capital controls.
So my understanding is that Vladimir Putin may be delusional. He's certainly very cynical. And even the German Chancellor Angela Merkel even suggests that maybe he's losing his mind. Apparently, he did get an earful at the G20 summit recently in Australia, and supposedly he was quite shocked to recognize how isolated he was, and that's why he left early. What's your understanding of his mental state, if that is an issue?
Well, I don't have any special insight into Mr. Putin's mental state, but I think it's pretty clear that he has painted himself into a corner where there's no elegant way for him to back down in terms of his foreign policy, where attacking the West rhetorically and otherwise in the case of Ukraine is a way to direct the attention of Russian residents away from domestic economic problems, away from the fact that the benefits derived from the Russian economy go to a very few rather than to the masses, and toward this hostility from the West, as Mr. Putin paints it. How does he back down gracefully? It's not clear that to me that there is a way for him to do that. He's a stubborn man, and adversity may only make him more stubborn, which is another reason for thinking things in Russia will get much worse before they get better.
Again, I'm speaking with Barry Eichengreen, who's a professor of economics and political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, a research fellow of the Center for Economic Policy Research, and previously served as a senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund. And his latest book is China, Asia, and the New World Economy. So in terms of what's arrayed against Putin in the real world, in terms of the economic, the sanctions as a result of Crimea and Ukraine, and now the falling oil prices, which clearly are having a devastating effect. Since that it's a sort of, I think Senator John McCain referred to Russia as a not a country but a gas station. But it would seem to me that, given Putin's narrative, which is working, where he's popular, and the whole country's in a delusionary bubble about the outside world because he's managed to completely take over the media. And as I mentioned earlier, there's no reporting on the economic conditions and the collapse of the ruble on Russian state media, which dominates the airwaves. But surely Putin can use the, just as Castro has done and now the Venezuelan leader will do, as soon as you impose sanctions on countries, and Castro's lasted, what, for 70 years or something, the leadership automatically has an excuse, don't they, that, you know, your economic woes are not because of my, in Putin's case, the extraordinary theft of the treasury by me and the Siloviki around me, but rather because of the American imperialists.
Well, I think he is working as hard as he can to turn the sanctions against the West. The problem he has is that his single strongest weapon, namely threatening energy supplies to Western Europe, becomes weaker in an environment where energy is abundant and can come not only from Russia but from other sources as well. His strategy for maintaining and gaining additional domestic support has been to try to elevate Russia's stature as a geopolitical and military force to be reckoned with. But for how long will that really substitute for a deteriorating domestic economy? If the ruble loses half or two-thirds of its value against the dollar, and the euro and the price of imported foodstuffs go up to that extent, I would think that will have domestic political repercussions. Russia is not North Korea. They may control the airwaves, but they don't control the internet completely.
But I do believe, though, that in by and large, what will happen here is that Putin won't necessarily suffer. He's basically got up to $80 billion stashed abroad. And that's one of the paradoxes of Putin's regime, is that on the one hand, it's a criminal regime in many ways in league with the criminal underworld. And some of the statistics I've seen lately indicate that the black economy, global black economy, could be up to 50% of the world economy. So there's a powerful kind of criminal element there. But on the other hand, of course, ironically, when they stash their money abroad while undermining the legal economy, they also want stability from the legal economy, don't they, in order to preserve their money abroad.
That's right. And I think Putin relies on the support of a small number of powerful owners of energy companies and other enterprises, those guys with the bank accounts abroad. Access to which may now become more difficult. So he relies on their support as well as the support of the military. Can he count on it indefinitely? I don't know any better than anyone else, but Russia may be moving toward a test of that proposition more rapidly than people have been assuming. Strong men are strong until they're suddenly weak. just like currencies are strong until you wake up one day and everybody is fleeing.
But the pattern so far of sanctions going, you know, way back, even, you know, go back to apartheid, whatever, usually sanctions are brought in because you can't go any further with the military means, and it's kind of a palliative for those who are imposing them. And usually they end up punishing the people and not the leaders. So at what point do you think, it's clearly this is going to punish the Russian people, they're already being punished. And will it get worse for them? And you know, I mean, one of the fears that a lot of Russian specialists that I speak to say that as bad as Putin is, you know, if there's some kind of coup inside Russia, it's most likely to come from the right, not the left.
Well, I think you're right about the pain falling mainly on the shoulders of the common men and women of Russia. I think you're right about the fact that sanctions tend to have little effect or even contrary effects more often than they succeed. But what's going on here is not so much sanctions as I think low oil prices that are going to persist for an extended period. The sanctions have been on for months. What's new is the sudden weakness of oil prices that has affected the Russian economy more strongly than any other economy, and the ruble more strongly than any other currency. So are the weak oil prices the fault or are they caused by the West? If you look at global petroleum markets, there is a supply shock that OPEC is still pumping out petroleum even though the prices are low, and a demand shock that China has slowed down and is importing and using less energy as a result. Those are the big events that I think are hitting the Russian economy at the moment, and it's going to be hard for Putin to turn them to his advantage and use them against the West.
And, of course, President Obama will sign the congressional legislation that just was passed, increasing sanctions on Russia. So the screws are tightening, both in terms of oil prices plummeting and sanctions being ratcheted up. And it's pretty clear that Putin would like to find a way out from under American domination of the global economy, particularly the SWIFT system of banking, MasterCard and Visa, etc. Is there any chance that he and various rogue states in the criminal economy could find their alternative way, which would then free them up to have an utterly criminally controlled banking system as opposed to the transparency that the current system imposes?
No, I don't think so. So Russia and North Korea between them are not going to be able to create an alternative clearing system. People began talking about this when Putin suggested that he would initiate discussions with the Chinese about a way to do clearing between the ruble and the Chinese renminbi without going through the dollar or any other Western currency. China is going to be less enthusiastic about being in leagues with the Russians, given what's going on to the Russian economy at the moment and given the desperation to which Putin will be driven.
Well, apparently they're already renegotiating these gas deals that they signed recently because the ruble's falling.
Yeah, so I think we will see more of that when Russia is driven to imposing capital controls, as it most likely will be. Any kind of foreign investment of that sort will be off the table.
So just in closing then, Barry Eichengreen, given that the sanctions are a blunt instrument and that oil prices are going down and that Russia's going to have more and more problems, is there any way, to your mind, to have smart sanctions in spite of the fact that the Russian people live in this delusionary bubble and it's very hard to get any truth about the real world to them? Is there any other way than having to punish the Russian people in order to punish this leader?
I think Western Europe can do something in terms of weaning itself from Russian oil and gas, and they are moving in that direction, but moving toward renewables and in cases other than that of Germany toward nuclear power is not something that you do overnight. But I think what has limited the leverage of the West over Russia has been Western Europe's dependence on Russian oil and gas, something that they now need to address. That won't solve the problems of 2014 or 2015, but it'll prevent them and us from getting in the same box again.
But again, these are long-term trends that are detrimental to Russia and the Russian people.
And I think such are the consequences of the policies that Putin's government has been following. The Chinese don't want to be party to a clearing agreement with this Russia, and Western Europe doesn't want to depend on energy imported from Russia. Those are not favorable trends from Russia's point of view, but they're the consequences, the direct consequences of the policies that Putin has been following.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Barry Eichengreen.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Barry Eichengreen, who's a professor of economics and political science at the University of California, Berkeley. He's a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, a research fellow of the Center for Economic Policy Research, and previously served as senior policy advisor at the International Monetary Fund. His books include Emerging Giants, China and India in the World Economy, What G20 Leaders Must Do to Stabilize Our Economy and Fix the Financial System, and China, Asia, and the New World Economy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back, joined in the studio by Juan Cole, and we'll be discussing the continuing hype associated with the Islamic State.
تني بجوز عيونه خالص مار الحنطاوي
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com. And his books include Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks, Ian.
And just start out with the story of the moment, which is this bizarre incident in Sydney, Australia, and the extent to which anybody seems to be able to expropriate the Islamic State sort of version of jihadism, even though this character is an Iranian, a Shiite who apparently converted to Sunni Islam, is wanted by the authorities in Iran. They tried to get him extradited from Australia. He is complicit in the murder of his wife. He's got about 40 sexual assault charges against him, and he's been running around pretending he's an imam and shouting on street corners to the point where the local Muslim community in Sydney, Australia, have completely disowned him, and yet somehow he wasn't on anybody's list, and then he pulls off this extraordinary stunt. So this is like franchising the franchise to the extremes, isn't it? I mean, in other words, anybody can jump on that bandwagon.
Yes, it's a form of hype, of course, and it's connived at, and we shouldn't fall for it. I mean, this guy is just a whack job, and it's as though, you know, some person randomly sort of started selling hamburgers on a sidewalk one day and declared that they were McDonald's, and then they were bad, and McDonald gets blamed for it. And the poor Muslim.
But McDonald's could sue, though. In this case, who intervenes with the copyright?
Yeah, there's nobody to sue. Yeah. And unfortunately, there's a tendency in mainstream Western societies to tag Islam with these guys. Right. Imagine if white people got tagged with all the crazies amongst us. Even the very prominent ones amongst us, we probably wouldn't want to have anything to do with. So if some random person tags your community, that's very bad. And we really – I mean, the Western press really should resist this temptation of hype. I mean, this guy, you know, his extremism dates back like a month. And anyway, he's not in his right mind. Too much of one chemical, not enough of another. So the fact that he wanted a flag, you know, that's just not relevant to anything.
So are you then arguing that this is a in terms of the media, this is kind of a political version of the Kardashians? In other words, it's just the kind of cheap focus that we have on if it bleeds, it leads?
It's worse than that. Sometimes the Kardashians are a little bit interesting. I mean, this guy is not interesting. He just should have been hospitalized a long time ago. It's about prejudice and bias and editorial decisions. So it's not that it bleeds that it leads. It's that if it's something to do with Islam, it leads. And the mere fact that, you know, there are 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, you can't go around making all of them newsworthy.
Sure. Well, I think your point's well taken, because if this were just a criminal incident, a hostage taking in a restaurant in a distant country like Australia, it wouldn't have got the headlines. But it was the idea that he put this black flag up, and then it raised the specter of Islamic terrorism. Suddenly the global media goes nuts.
Yeah, but also, you know, we have a tendency to mark minority communities so that if some crazy Ku Klux Klan guy took hostages in a convenience store in Louisiana and asked for a Confederate flag, that also wouldn't be national, much less international news.
So, Juan Cole, in terms of what's really going on then with the Islamic State, not with this whack job pretending to be a member, there are apparently – they are suffering some military reverses, and the Peshmerga are getting stronger. I'm always mystified by the behavior of the Turks, particularly in terms of what's going on in the siege of Kobani. But then you hear on the Syrian front that the rebels, and that tends to be either al-Nusra or the Islamic State, have just captured a couple of important bases. So again, you get back to this extraordinary contradiction in the U.S. policy.
Yes. Well, you know, my own view is that Daesh, which is what the Arabs call ISIL, and I think it's a better term for it.
And what does it mean? It's a colloquial
term.
It's
just the acronym in Arabic. But it means that we don't have to keep using the word Islamic for them.
I see.
Which they're not. You know, they're just criminals. They're gangsters and human traffickers and murderers and so forth. So I call them Daesh. Daesh, from the beginning to the end, is just type. There's no there there. They didn't conquer Mosul. The people of Mosul rose up against their government, and you know, Daesh was one of the groups that they cooperated with to do that. They have the town of Raqqa as their capital. It's 60,000 people. I mean, if it were in the United States, you know, you couldn't find it on a map. Right. And to hype them as a state or as a security threat or whatever, it's just from the beginning there was no reason to treat them as so important. Yes, maybe it was important that they not be allowed to maraud around, but I don't expect us to be dealing with them 5 years from now. I don't think people will put up with them locally that long, and I think apparently everybody in the world hates them, so that even the Chinese are offering to bomb them to the Iraqi government.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. That's what Iraqi Foreign Minister Ibrahim Jaafari said, that he had a sidebar with his Chinese counterpart, and the Chinese perfectly willing to drop some Chinese bombs on Daesh and polish them off. So the Russians don't want them there. The Iranians don't want them there. The Chinese don't want them there. The Americans, the British, the French. After a while, you know, it's very unlikely they'll be there. And then there's all this hype, which is partly European in origin, about Daesh, you know, attracting the young people and being ideologically seductive. And you know it's not. I mean, the Sunni Arabs of Iraq answered an opinion poll in 2012. They asked them, you know, should religion and state be separated? 75% said yes. These are the most secular people in the world. And it's not that they've all changed their mind in the last 2 years. It's that the living under that Iraqi Shiite government was just so unpleasant for them that they did a deal with the devil. And, you know, David Cameron came out and said 400 young British Muslim men went off to fight for them. But – and that's not very many people. You know, there are nearly 4 million British Muslims now. The population of Muslims in the UK is growing rapidly. And that's zero. It's a tiny, tiny number. You can get 400 people to do almost anything. We had cults in the United States like that one that they committed suicide so as to catch a ride on the asteroid. I mean, that was over 40 people, I think, committed suicide there. So that you could get 400 of these young teenagers to go off and fight. And, you know, when they come back, they say things, well, they made us wash dishes and it was unpleasant and we had to get up early and fight. And they're naive, you know. So Cameron, when he hypes this kind of thing, you know, the threat of Daesh to Europe, he's really just competing with racist groups like UKIP for parliamentary seats.
Well, but over here, of course, it's the one thing in this budget process that just went through with this $1.1 trillion spending bill with an enormous giveaway to Wall Street, etc. The one thing that Obama, the Democrats, and the Republicans all agreed on was funding the war against the so-called Islamic State or Daesh.
Well, in a way, but, you know, there was another wrinkle to that bill, which was that they did basically agree to buy bombs from American munitions manufacturers and use them.
675,000 each, do you know those?
Yeah.
Those JDAMs?
Yes, I know.
It's unbelievable how expensive they are.
Oh, we're spending – first we paid for the tanks, and then when the Iraqi army ran away and gave them to Daesh, right. Now we're paying
for the JDAMs to shoot them.
I mean, it's millions of dollars each time. But the Congress declined to put in the money for training and raising up a moderate Free Syria army in Syria. The logical thing that would happen is if the U.S. and its allies come in against Daesh in Syria, either al-Qaeda will benefit, the Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate, or Bashar al-Assad will benefit, the Ba'ath government, which tortured 10,000 people to death and is just horrible. So if there's no third alternative, and the Free Syrian Army, you know, the old one that had existed and didn't get much help from the United States, has collapsed. And Idlib, where was one of their bases, has now fallen into the hands of al-Qaeda, and they have captured American weapons and so forth. So yes, I mean, if you look at this policy, Congress says, yes, we'll bomb. No, we won't do anything practical. So it's a kind of symbolic politics. And of course, you'll never, ever take back cities like Mosul or Raqqa from Daesh if all you're doing is bombing. The bombing can't create territory taken on the ground. So –
But that gets to the heart of the question, doesn't it? The heart of the matter, which is the Sunni. You know, they're the ones that have been dealt out of the new Iraq. They're the ones that have made this alliance of convenience with these criminals. But their issues aren't going to go away, and the Saudis aren't going to stop supporting them, and the Sunnis, the diaspora is not going to stop supporting them. At what point, and there's some questions about whether this new Iraqi leader is still a part of the old guard or the new. He's made some gestures that indicate he's not as bad as Maliki, but still I don't get the impression that anybody on the Sunni side really trusts this government in Baghdad. In fact, they despise it, from my understanding.
That's right. Well, the government in Baghdad is run by the fundamentalist Shiite party, the Dawah party. Haider al-Abadi, the new prime minister, same as the old prime minister in this regard, is from that party. And, you know, when David Petraeus and other U.S. military officers created the Sunni militias, the Sons of Iraq, the purpose of which was for Iraqis to fight al-Qaeda, they recruited about 100,000 of them at the high point and got them paid. And when the U.S. gradually withdrew from that whole process, they expected the Iraqi government to pick them up, you know, make them police or soldiers, integrate them. Only 17,000 of the 100,000 were given jobs. Many of them, since they had opposed al-Qaeda, when they lost their backing from the government, they had a big red target on their backs. They were assassinated. Al-Maliki, the previous prime minister, who was a hardline Shiite, actually insisted on prosecuting some of them who were heroes in the fight against al-Qaeda because they had previously been part of Sunni militias that carried out terrorist actions. So the Sunni Arabs who were organized to fight al-Qaeda in Iraq were frankly treated extremely badly, let us say. And now for Haider al-Abadi to go back to those same people and say, no, no, let's do it again. You know, it's like Lucy offering the football to Charlie Brown. These guys are saying they're not going to fall for it. So there have been a few clan societies that have taken up this effort. Abu Nimr is one of them. But they've been so far hung out to dry. They've had hundreds of members of their tribe killed by Daesh. They haven't gotten a lot of close air support. They haven't gotten a lot of government support, which Haider al-Abadi says is coming. So obviously, this whole situation is a political situation. It has to be solved politically. It's not clear that the politicians involved are the people who can do this deal.
Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, who is a professor of modern Middle East and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com, and his books include Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World, and his latest, The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. And Juan, you'll be speaking under the banner of TruthDig Presents Monsters of Our Own Creation, America's Role in the Middle East. So, along with Leslie Coburn, and moderated by Robert Scheer, give me a sense of that title, Monsters of Our Own Creation, America's Role in the Middle East.
Well, I think the argument that I'll be making Thursday evening in Santa Monica will be that the fact that 40% of Iraq has gone into the hands of this horrible Daesh organization is clearly a direct outgrowth of U.S. policy in Iraq. Now that seems to be our big national security challenge. We are the ones who created it for ourselves.
Well, there's an interesting article in the UK Guardian a few days ago on the genesis of Daesh that indicated that this was really a kind of naked case of blowback, that all of these Sunni prisoners, I think something like 30,000, I think, in 24 different camps, and at Camp Buka, where Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was interned, apparently this was a perfect petri dish to create a movement because, one, you were free from the Shiite death squads. You were protected by the Americans, and you had a roof over your head, and you had all the time in the world to organize, and that's what they did.
Yeah, many of the high Daesh commanders in Iraq had spent time in Camp Buka under U.S. Supervision. And the U.S. had a policy in Iraq of if a bomb went off or if there was a sniping incident or whatever, they would just arrest all the Sunni young men in the area. And so they had massive numbers of detainees. Some of them were probably tortured, Ian. And we were having this big debate about whether torture is useful or not. I mean, what a depth to which we have sunk that's our question is, does it work?
But the other question is, did you, by brutalizing these people, create the very movement that you're now so hysterical about?
I think without any doubt that's part of the story here, that the torture helped to create Daesh.
So what's your sense then of how the American public are going to deal with this? If it's a case of political theater, as far as I can tell, the contractors will make out on this. We can't put boots on the ground, so they'll come in, do whatever they do. And as you pointed out, you can't bomb your way into some kind of solution, that there has to be a political solution with the Sunni, and that's not certainly doesn't seem beyond the cards. My sense is that this is a political hot potato because the Republicans don't want to be reminded that it was the Bush-Cheney folly that created this mess in the first place. So they want to forget about it. And Obama, on the other hand, he doesn't want to be the president that loses Iraq, even though arguably Iraq has already lost. And perhaps Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush will have the same problem. Neither, so they're just going to keep kicking the can down the road in this theater?
Well, de facto, the U.S. policy in Iraq now is containment of Daesh. And that is probably practical enough in the sense you wouldn't want them to take Baghdad or Erbil in Kurdistan. And so they're containing them. There's no evidence that they're pushing them back, by the way, in any significant way. I think it does work politically as well as strategically in the sense that the journalists and the opposition party are going to constantly be asking, well, what were you doing about this security threat? And, well, your answer is that you're bombing them. And so it all goes away. In fact, you know, the hysteria about all this, which kind of ruled in summer and early fall, is now gone to the point where there are fairly major things happening in Iraq that are no longer getting reported in our Western press.
Like what?
Oh, well, I shouldn't say not reported in the Western press because we have wire services that do a pretty comprehensive job, and the New York Times is on top of things to some extent. But in our mass media, there are things that don't show up on television. The fact that Daesh has actually made advances in Al Anbar province, has taken Heat and some other towns down there, hasn't been much commented upon. The fighting, which has been quite significant in the refiner area of Beji. Again, it's not that you couldn't find a wire service report on it, or maybe in the best newspapers it's not mentioned someplace, but it's not as though, you know, you turn on cable news and that's the lead. And so I think in a way people have absorbed the information that northern Iraq and western Iraq has been lost to this organization. And they're only going to really be interested in the story again if there's some movement of the front, which so far there hasn't been.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Juan Cole.
You're very welcome, Ian, anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com. And his books include Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.